Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Today our guest is James Davis, an alternative educator in the occupied state of upstate New York. How are you doing there, James?
Yeah, I'm doing good, man. Just living under the man and trying to be free, you know?
Living the dream under the man?
Yeah. Well, I beg for permission to live free by running a nonprofit, so that allows me to live a lot freer than most, I guess, even though I have to beg for permission to do so.
How's that working out?
Yeah, it's going really well. You know, it's always really crazy when you deal with nonprofit stuff. Like, you know, the IRS is currently trying to fine us for back tax returns, even though we don't pay taxes. So that's kind of funny. But I really, really enjoy it, you know, not having to charge customer sales tax, not having to pay tax when we buy things. Really, the only tax that comes out of here is stuff through the payroll employer. So that feels good. I like to do that, even if we do have to beg for permission to do it.
What do you mean they're trying to fine you? Like, you, even though you don't pay taxes, you have to file taxes and you were late?
Yeah, so nonprofits have to file a 990. And so when I got here 2 years ago, they were turning over the, turning over the business model and what have you. And so the board tried to file for an extension, but somehow it didn't work or something. I don't know all the details, but so it went in a couple months late, and they want to fine us like $3,700. And there's no reason behind it, you know, no math, no long list of reasons. They just sent us a bill for $3,700, and there's a long, like, arduous appeals process that we're undergoing right now.
Wow, that sounds like a drag. Do you have a nonprofit lawyer to help you with that?
We do. I mean, it's mostly a CPA thing. It shouldn't be a big deal. I think they even actually came out and said that they were basically going to be fundraising on back tax returns. So I think it'll mostly just come down to writing, you know, a letter begging for forgiveness and, you know, hoping that they listen. But that's, I think, mostly what they want is the compliance. And it really makes them really frustrated when you are a few months late on getting your homework in, you know.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about, in general, you know, without going into any specifics of anything that'll harm you, the idea of complying, you know, choosing your own battles. Like, a lot of people who think like we do, ANCAP kind of people who think that grown adults don't need leaders, which is, you know, not a very large percentage of the population. Most people complain about the leaders and want to have different leaders or put limits on the leaders. You know, and leaders don't really like limits. You know, a lot of people I know tend to live their whole life in defiance and end up kind of getting screwed by the man. Talk a bit about doing what the man says and keeping your soul and keeping more free. If it's possible to keep more free with some compliance. Boy, that's a really horrible sounding question, but do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I really do, because you know, sometimes I dream about what life would be like if I didn't feel like a sense of duty to my family, or you know, if I wasn't worried that I would disappoint my parents or something, you know. And I wonder if I would do civil disobedience and go to jail for what I believe in and that sort of thing. But I also think about all the people I can really impact in a positive way just by living life the way I can, you know, and using these freedoms that I do have and being grateful for the freedoms I do have while also acknowledging that they're not my ultimate goal, you know. You know, I won't wave the flag around and say that this is the best country in the world or anything like that, but I'm really grateful that I don't live 1,000 years ago in Rome or something, or, you know, there are a lot worse things to do. And so basically what I try to do is just interact with as many people as possible and treat them as well as possible. And whenever those teachable moments come up, you know, when someone's complaining about the man or is talking about some involuntary interaction, I try to talk about how much better it would be if that was a voluntary interaction, and try to find common ground with folks. And for me, that's really satisfying, even if it's just a little bit of a scaffolded approach to liberty as opposed to going out and getting my musket, you know?
Yeah, I don't really think going out and getting the musket is a solution, especially since they have drones, and drone beats musket in the what's the game you play where you throw your hands out and it's paper, rock, scissors, rock, paper, scissors.
I think you got it. Yeah, I think you pinned it down.
Yeah, drone beats musket. So elaborate on that a little bit more. And also, let me interject here for a second. Do you really worry what your parents think? You're like 30-something, aren't you?
I am like 30-something. I mean, it's not so much my parents. I use that as a kind of a way to group in all the people that I really care about that really wouldn't understand if I chose to, say, go to jail and leave the raising of my children to my wife, you know, or just the people who really wouldn't understand, you know, the people who have a lot of stake in who I am to them, you know, like, especially, you know, with the camp I'm at now, there are really a lot of people who rely on me for a lot of things and who really, it would really be distracting for them, I think, if I was out, you know, getting arrested for smoking cannabis in the central square of Syracuse or something, you know.
Yeah.
I think that would really, really harm my relationship with them. And I don't think that that's something you should judge someone for, but I understand why one, you know, being raised in this culture would judge someone else for doing that. So I mostly just try not to engage in those activities just because I don't want to distract from what I believe to be the more important things that I'm up to.
I disappointed both my parents in a lot of ways my whole life before I ever became politically active. And when I became politically active, my mother had already passed away, but my dad actually agrees with me now more than ever. He's a constitutionalist, kind of a Ron Paul Republican, and I'm less government loving than that. But, you know, I mean, he's been an in-studio guest on the Freedom Fiends before and was really happy about it and shared it with all his friends. And we asked him really tough questions and were kind of, you know, he was talking about the need for small government. And I'm like, well, if you have this agency, aren't you going to end up with that agency? And, you know, kind of subtly and lovingly tearing apart his belief system and kind of got him to a point of agreeing at least to, well, you may have a point there. And also he said that that we're probably going to end up in jail for speaking our mind. And I said, well, what should we do? And he said, probably just keep speaking it. So that was kind of interesting to me.
Well, I wonder sometimes, like I do foresee a time sometime in the future where, because there are certain things I'm not willing to bend on, you know, like we had an encounter with a police officer here who came and just drove his cruiser right through the main road in camp, you know, 20 miles over our private road speed limit, just buzzed right through, drove to an outskirt of camp and without telling anyone, you know, this is while summer camp was in session. So we have no background check on this person. We have no idea who he is. And we have 100 kids here who are trying to keep safe and have a good time. And the kids were in a frenzy, you know, because when kids see cops, they don't think, yes, someone's here to protect us. You know, they think something awful happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've got 100 kids in my charge here and a man with a gun just showed up.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I chased him. I got in my car and grabbed a counselor to come with me. So, you know, just to get accountability. And I drove up a hill and, he went to the deepest part in camp for who knows why. And, you know, we were kind of driving opposite ways down a one way path there. And I got out of my car and he said, you know, hands where I can see him. And so I said, okay, you know, and he said, what are you doing here? And I said, what are you doing here? You know, like, we own the camp. This is our property. And he said, oh, well, I'm out. I'm testing my radios because this is the end point of the county. So, and I said, well, if you're ever going to come back here again, you need to ask permission. You are not welcome here unless you bring documentation or warrant or you ask permission in advance. You know, we've been helpful to local municipalities in the past and various things. And if you want to test your radio, it's fine, but you can't just roll in here in a cruiser at 30 miles an hour. And, you know, I gave him a fairly stern talking to, and the counselor that was with me was like pretty surprised by that, you know, thought it was unnecessary that I was like overly harsh. And I tried to explain property rights to him and things. And that was a moment where I was willing to, you know, stir the pot. You know, there are certain things I'm just not going to bend on. And so I imagine at some point that if one of those comes to bear, like, you know, for speaking my mind, for instance, you know, I'm not going to stop speaking my mind no matter how much someone threatens me. Just, I can't do that. So if I go to jail for something like that, I think my parents and those who care about me would understand. And that would be I think that would be great probably for the liberty movement, because I think there are a lot of people who do feel I have a lot of credibility. And if I were in prison for something insane, then I think that would push them closer to understanding the need for a voluntary society.
Well, yeah, I see the point in that kind of stuff, but I'm not trying to put myself in any kind of situation where I know people, and I know you're not saying you'd try to get arrested, but I know a lot of people who try to get arrested, and I don't know. It's not for me. I'll say that. You know, I'm not going to be the Rosa Parks of this. I'm going to be more the commentator, which a lot of people,
I really don't want to be either.
You know, a lot of people think that's kind of pussy, but that's what I'm doing. Basically, my thing is, if I'm going to end up in jail, it's going to be for something that is currently legal under the Constitution and the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America.
Right. And I'm in the same camp, and I think that I would put you in this category too. I just think I have more gifts to offer than standing in front of a police car and getting thrown in jail. You know, I think I can just do better than that, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm
curious what his reaction was. You didn't ever tell that part of the story.
He was really abrasive at first, and then, you know, because I think he wasn't used to being spoken back to, probably. And then he was he didn't apologize, but he definitely kind of left with his tail between his legs. And I called their district office to complain. And, you know, the guy on the other end was very friendly at first because he knows the camp and, you know, we're becoming more well-known. But then when I started to really say how unacceptable this was and how I needed them to really understand that this was private property and so on, the guy really kind of was understanding and yes, sir, type stuff, but not warm, you know, not the way I would treat my customers when they're disappointed in my service, you know.
Well, so, they have a monopoly on that service, so they don't have to be polite.
Oh yeah, this is totally it. And it really shocks me over and over as someone who runs a business, you know, with, you know, several $100,000 budget and many employees and hundreds and thousands of customers, you know, the way we treat our customers. And when the smallest thing goes wrong, you know, it's staff meetings and we're wringing our hands and how can we make it right? And we're giving people things for free. And then, I find recently I was having this thought that it seems like the more regulation there is, the worse customer service I get. So like the best customer service isn't something like, you know, a camp, because we all need the business. So we're going to treat you like gold. But then even like in the medical profession, they run this business model where it's expected that you'll be served half an hour after you get there. I mean, it's just completely insane, but the barriers to entry in that field are so great that what do they need customer service for? You know, they're turning away clients because there's so few of them. So,
yeah. So where do you think things are headed? I hear a lot of things that upset me, a lot of tyrannies, a lot of people being poked by the man. My friend Nima made up a really funny one recently. He said legalese is the lube. Legal-ease is the brand name of the lube that the man uses when he does his thing to you.
Dude, I love that.
Yep. And and it's the only actual product produced by the government.
That's fantastic. Actually, another funny story about legalese is there's an HR person who came to advise the camp on some HR issues. And one of the things was apparently there's a law where you have to pay if someone's an hourly employee, you have to pay them weekly, because the implication, which is really offensive, is that this person, if they're being paid hourly, is probably not responsible enough to budget their money over a 2-week period. So this is a New York state law, but if you're paid hourly, you must be paid weekly, because otherwise it's like oppressing this poor person who's too stupid to budget for themselves.
Is that your guess, or have they actually said that?
This is a person who's been in HR for 30 years who said this is the law in New York State 100%.
The reason for the law, is that your assumption that that's the reason for the law, or did she tell you that?
She didn't use the stupid language, but she said, yes, that the reason is to help lower income people budget their money.
Okay. So go on.
Yeah, it's completely nuts. And so she puts this out there and she says, you know, the fines aren't very large for this. And the chances of someone coming back on you for something like this is very small. So, and for, you know, for people who don't do payroll, if you go through a payroll service, you pay per pay period. So if you do 52 pay periods, you're going to pay twice as much as 26 and so on. And so we kind of looked at it and thought, you know, it doesn't make sense to increase our double our budget for this, you know, just because of this offensive law. And we got into the discussion, our board meeting, about bad laws. And it was a really interesting discussion because some people came from the perspective that the law is moral. And so we got to have a really good discussion, of course, you know, through this framework of, you know, whether just because New York State says, does that actually mean it's the most logical thing to do? And my board is not liberty people, you know, but they were really able to see that this was insane. And that was really a fun discussion to have.
You know, it's really interesting, people who think that because something's the law, it's moral. And I've actually heard people equate, you know, manslaughter with running a stop sign, or, you know, having your hedge too high. Like, they're basically like, laws are laws. Right. If you break a law, you're an equally bad person, no matter what, which is just insane to me. And it's interesting, though, the hypocrisy that I can always see in those people. I mean, let's pick on the left for a minute. I mean, because really there's no difference between the left and the right. They just want to steal equally for whatever they like. But, okay, someone,
Absolutely. The
archetypal, you know, retired ex-hippie, you know, who works for, let's say, a nonprofit educational organization, not yours, but I'm thinking of another, some people I know actually in your area, but not you. So Let's just think, you know, your typical stereotypical liberal. Okay. They think guns should be completely outlawed. They think only police and the military should have guns, but they're anti-military. They believe that the government should take care of everything, but that cops are bad, but they don't understand that nothing the government does can be done without the cops to enforce it. Here's what gets really weird to me. They believe that, and I'm painting a cartoon picture here, but you know, everything in this rings true with somebody, if someone they know, that they're like, oh man, that person doesn't get it. They believe that you shouldn't break any laws, but that the laws need to be changed on certain things because the laws aren't right. And but they believe you absolutely have to obey all laws, and if they're on a jury, they'll convict the person for breaking the law, even if it's not a law, a so-called crime that has a victim. But they're always fans of Martin Luther King. I'm a fan of Martin Luther King too. He broke bad laws. Right. And he said that, you know, that breaking a bad law is a moral imperative, that a good person breaks a bad law. And but those same people don't think that you should break bad laws now, and they don't even think there's a such thing as bad laws, except the ones made by Republicans, which have to be changed, but you still have to abide by them because they're the law.
Well, totally, and this is why. So I see this as a cause for optimism, which is mostly just how I see the world in general. But I see it as a cause for optimism because I think about other really crazy ideas brought on by a lack of critical thinking, and I'm turned, you know, someone who runs, you know, a Christian camp, I'm turned to ideas of, say biblical literalism when it comes to like laws from old books, you know, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, things like that. Thinking people look at these things and say, well, this is just completely crazy, right? I mean, basically everyone agrees these days that these things are nuts, but even 15 years ago, the conversation around, say, gay marriage was totally different. You know, recently I counted those of my Facebook friends who had made that pink equals sign their profile picture to come out in support of equality in marriage, and the vast, overwhelming, and disproportionate majority of people were people I know who identify as Christians. And so these are people who have said, okay, we're agreeing that certain things here are absurd, and we're ready to think critically. Still more people, you know, and I think you count yourself in this field, and many, many, many do, who have looked at the faith as a whole and said, there's so many unthinking people here and a lot of really unthinking things, and it's, you know, contradictory. And so they are rejecting it wholesale. And so, you know, intellectual folks are running from matters of faith, you know, on the grounds that there's not much logic there. But 30 years ago, that would have seemed like an absolute impossibility, and people that were suggesting things to the contrary would have been looked at as heretics. You know, they would have been total outcasts. And so when we think about matters of the state, that just seems so obvious, you know, and we're looking at these other people that seem to be smart, and they just don't seem to understand where the hypocrisy is. I mean, the person you just painted is like an unrealistic cartoon character, like you said, but that really describes most people that I know in the left sort of movement, and the people on the right are the same way. I think you say that the government's evil, and so we should only put them in charge of the most important things.
These ideas can't hold up forever. Conservatism is the belief that government is flawed, so government should only do really important things. That's the way I've heard it put.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And so these things are going to the.
They have to go away. I mean, with the proliferation of information, information's never spread faster than it is right now. And I just see this as a huge cause for optimism. The fact that they could have constructed the state so much more logically and done such a better job if their goal was to control everyone for all time, and there's so many huge gaping holes in it that they just did a really bad job of making their teams, I guess, is my point. I think they really screwed that up, and I think that will come back to bite them someday.
Well, there's a theory that I kind of subscribe to by Larkin Rose, who says that if they wanted to be in control and use everyone for tax cattle, which seems to be their goal, they would be a lot smarter to turn down the heat on the boiling frog and quit being so quick about taking away liberties. Taking away liberties is a problem for them and going to make it unsustainable. If they wanted to have a 1,000-year reign that ends up, you know, oh, let's say at Brave New World, which is, you know, not a horrible anti-utopia like 1984, where the government kills you in the end and you're happy they did it because you're finally free. Mm-hmm. You know, Brave New World is an anti-utopia where people are controlled with lots of drugs and sex and everyone has enough food, and it's not, you know, the people living under the stairs or Soylent Green or anything like that. If they wanted to have that kind of anti-utopia where everyone is controlled and pretty docile and producing and the people in charge are living really lush, they really should slow down the slippery slope. But there's a thing about sociopathy to where it just doesn't know how to check itself. And I think that's what we're witnessing right now. But at the same time, we have more ability to talk to each. I think there's more free speech than there's ever been. I mean, there were times in the last 100 years when this having this conversation we're having right now and putting it out to the public, and this is a pretty benign conversation. It's entertaining and it's informative, but compared to some of the subjects that we've covered on the Freedom Fiends, or that someone like, let's say, Alex Jones, who's kind of, you know, takes it to the limit and is on a lot of radio stations. I mean, that would not have happened 50 years ago. They would have thrown him and us and you in a cage for sedition, for speaking critically, for basically doing what the First Amendment allows.
Well, exactly. And I think that this is the grand misstep here, is that, you know, I think about my own path to liberty, and it mostly came through working with kids and education, as you know from previous discussions. But if they would have just done a good job with education, I would have never woken up to these ideas, because that was my big issue. You know, that was my big thing, was when my son was born, you know, and I worked with kids my whole life, and I've been trained to become a public school teacher, and then ultimately rejected it because there was something intangibly wrong with it that I just couldn't figure out what it was. You know, after I was in the classroom, I just didn't like it. And if they had just taken an earnest effort, for instance, to give kids an individualized education, or just use their government guns to really treat people like human beings in schools instead of like robots, I would have never bothered. I would have said, meh, whatever. I can live with all the other stuff, you know, because they're treating kids right. But they're just so terrible at every single thing they do that they just can't help but bring people to liberty through that, you know?
Well, also, I mean, there's a lot of problems with education. If you talk to you and I, we could enumerate them. But the problem with education from their standpoint is basically they're teaching people to read. That's their problem. You know, if they want to have the 1984 or the Brave New World tax farm, they need to not teach most of them to read and just have the betas who do the heavy lifting. And that's their problem, is they're teaching right. people to read. And they never anticipated the internet. And the technology is changing. It's kind of like how there are still copyright laws on the books, and occasionally they, you know, sue some 8-year-old girl for, you know, $20 million for downloading, you know, 4 pop songs. But the technology is such that there really isn't copyright law anymore. I mean, there's the law, and then there's the activity. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like how marijuana is illegal, but more people probably smoke it than smoke cigarettes. It's basically legal in a lot of places, and it's kind of gotten like that with free flow of information. They'd like to clamp down on a lot of it, and occasionally, you know, they'll throw someone in jail for something like tax evasion because they're speaking their mind. But they really can't stop the free flow of information. And they just made the mistake of teaching everyone to read.
Well, so here's a fascinating thing about reading, because reading is a really, really interesting topic, especially for folks who approach schooling the way I believe they should. So reading was initially, they moved the timetable up for reading in public schooling. The average age that most people prefer to learn to read when left to their own devices is typically much later. It's between the ages of 7 and 11, with the really early readers coming before that. Now, this was really inconvenient for the central planners, because kids who don't know how to read have a really tough time being obedient away from the classroom. They can't really do much follow-up. So they really love this idea of bringing school home. And so they said, oh, I know, we can force everyone to learn to read 2 years earlier and castigate the people who can't read and, you know, cast them aside and make them feel inferior for not having the proclivity to learn to read earlier. And so they really wanted to take up more of people's time away from the classroom. And so that's why the current curriculum calls for reading at a much earlier age than is developmentally appropriate for many kids. And, you know, even their simple brain functions, you know, recognizing sequencing of letters, you know, associating phonetics, so sounds with the appearance of an image. You know, most kids just don't resonate with that right away unless their, you know, brain is developed in a certain way. And so it's this really big double-edged sword where they actually taught people to read to try and control them. But then reading becomes, on the flip side, reading, like you said, is the ultimate key to liberty, and which is why you never need to force someone to read, because every kid, every human being understands that knowledge is power. I mean, my son is 2, he'll be 3 in June, and he already understands that these symbols, you know, numbers and letters are the key to his personal freedom. You know, he knows that if he can figure out these words, then he can read the book on his own. You know, then he can figure out how to navigate the YouTube videos on his own. Show me how to use this mouse. Show me how to do this thing. Because he doesn't want to be under the thumb of my control anymore, you know. and we try not to control him as much as possible, but he is constantly clawing for these bits of control. And ironically, we just try to shove down this tool that would be for a child's freedom before they're ready. And thus, well, actually, maybe it's brilliant, because that's why most adults hate to read, is because they were forced to read as kids, you know. It's crazy. I find reading fascinating.
I'm addicted to reading, to the point where, you know, Heinlein used this phrase, words in a row, and my wife reads really thick books because she needs words in a row to, like, clear her brain. And I'm like that. If I'm waiting in line at the post office, I'll pick up the pamphlet on how to get a post office box, just to read something. And my mother taught me to read before I went to kindergarten. And when I went to kindergarten in 1969, which they weren't really teaching people to read early back then, my first day in kindergarten, I picked up a book, you know, like a Dick and Jane book or whatever, and read it cover to cover out loud to the class. And that was kind of my first lesson in knowledge is power, is that several of the kids didn't like me because I did that, and the teacher was kind of suspect of me.
Absolutely, man. And this is why I think the current educational model is so jaded, and it's so it really thinks the worst of people. You know, it thinks that a human being would be too foolish to understand why reading would be so important, you know. And, you know, of course, the opposite has been found to be true. People that have been left to their own devices have taught themselves to read without any teachers at all, you know, just from picking it up through osmosis, you know, hearing other people read, or piecing out words together with images. Reading is found to be very similar to talking or walking, in that it's totally possible to learn just from observation and trial and error. So,
yep.
And of course, you learned to read probably because you were demonstrating a huge interest in it, you know, and then your mom picked up on that. You know, wisely followed through on it. So,
excellent. Well, let's go to the market here and sell a few things, and then come back for the second half.
All right.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
Did your world collapse when Ron Paul didn't win? Don't keep hoping for some great man to fix government through government. Complete your evolution today to full-on anarcho-capitalist. Reward your brain with the freedom beans and quit breaking your heart with some politician. While the libertarians argue,
but who would build the roads?
The freedom beans have already built the roads and moved on to making the great media content of the libertarian paradise. Freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com.
Yeah, welcome back to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. We're talking with James Davis, educator extraordinaire. How you doing, James?
Yeah, I'm doing great, man.
Cool, man. So education, what's wrong with it and how do you fix it? You got a half hour. I'm going to do my taxes.
Here
I'm kidding. I already did them. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so the question about what's wrong with education, I think, is covered really well in a lot of different places. And I think, you know, people coming from a liberty perspective sort of intuitively understand that the model is so based on coercion from the beginning of the funding to the end of the teacher-centered model. My long-term goal, I guess, is something my wife and I are actually currently in the process of potentially putting together out here in New York where we are, but perhaps forecasting and doing it someday in New Hampshire if we move out that way. The big question I think most people have about education, you know, I talk to parents all the time who will say, you know, I'm really understanding that my kid is just one of the kids who's getting put through the grinder of the public education system. You know, my kid is the kid who gets sent to the principal's office, who sits outside of the class. He just is bored by school. You know, he doesn't get it. He doesn't want to be there. What do I do, though? Because I need to work. I can't afford private school. I'm lost. You know, I need to send my kid to school. And this is a really heartbreaking conundrum for me, because it really is the state of dependency that I think most people are in. You know, we're raised with this money coming out of our paychecks through taxation to pay for schooling. We plan our adult lives around this free babysitting that's going to be there. And when it turns out that it's not as good as it was said to have been, we feel really trapped. And this is exactly what my wife and I were facing, where we realized in our previous life that it was going to be pretty tight to for just me to work and for her to stay home with kids. And we didn't really like the private school options in the area. So what we want to do is help those folks who want to homeschool their kids, but who find that to be infeasible, whether it's just because they don't think they could do it, they don't want to do it, they can't afford to do it for whatever reason. And we don't want to make a school, because making a school involves just countless hours of red tape, and in most cases they just won't let you do it anyway. And then there's other regulations, like, you know, certain amount of class hours, certain amount of this, that, and the other thing, state testing and so on, even when you do run a private school. So, you know, even Sudbury schools and other more admirable schools are subject to some of these regulations. So what our plan to do is, you know, since given that we're going to be having our kids at home anyway, assuming that that's what they want to do, is to open it up in sort of a co-op fashion. So parents who wanted to homeschool their kids and were going to be home anyway could come to wherever this location was. Where we are currently is an 850-acre facility with a private 45-acre lake and tons of buildings and no shortage of resources. So we're currently really well positioned to do this, to offer anything that a real learning environment would offer at no cost. You know, there's no overhead. So these folks could come in and enjoy these resources at some very marginal cost, and enjoy the community and pitch in that way. But then more exciting for me is for folks who want to have the benefits of homeschooling, or in particular unschooling, which is kind of like a child-directed learning environment where the kid can learn about whatever motivates them, that they could just drop their kids off. And they could simply report to the government that they were homeschooling their own children, and that in a given day, we would essentially be babysitting their kids. So the kid comes to, you know, right now we're at this camp, but if we were somewhere else, they could go there. The child comes, and then they spend the day doing whatever they want. The only consideration from us is that we won't force kids who come to do any work. We won't sit down and grind them down on their vocab test or whatever. But if parents do have educational goals for their kids, they can tell them things like, here's the work that you need to accomplish while you're at this place in a given day if you want to keep going there. So it really works for parents who do believe that kids need to learn on a certain schedule or what have you. And certainly we'll make ourselves available to help educate those kids who want to pursue academic learning. We'll make ourselves available for kids who want to pursue play or pursue, you know, covering themselves in mud or sleeping or whatever they want to do, you know. So that's, I think it's a really great way to subvert all these incredibly arduous regulations. And for parents, I think it's a total win-win. You know, you send your kids someplace where if they're motivated to do the work that you have for them, then, and because they love the place, which I can guarantee they will, you know, I think we have a really, really solid approach now to working with kids in a way that helps them construct their own learning environments, but where we're excited and active participants. That's how we run the camp, and the camp has been tremendously successful based on this model. And I think it's a great way just to stick it to folks who want to control how people are educating their kids.
Is there any educational value to covering yourself with mud?
Yeah, dude. I cover myself with mud frequently all throughout the summer. And the educational value there is that it's freeing, you know. One of the first things, we offer a program here called Outrageous Activities during camp. And it's, you know, all the activities are optional. But this is the most popular one because you just never know what's going to happen. And so one of the things we did was, there was one group of kids that wanted to take an expedition across the lake because one of the kids thought there might be a velociraptors over there. And so he planned to take this expedition, and he had recruited a few people to go with him. And so, you know, they got a counselor, and they were going across. And, you know, it's probably only about a half an hour ride in a kayak across the lake to get to the other side. And so I took a group of kids from Outrageous Activities, and we all went across the other side of the lake and just covered ourselves in mud from head to toe and pretended to be the native people on the other side when these kids got there. And it was a brilliant educational activity because it just showed these kids that it just doesn't, you can just do whatever, you know, just, you don't need to be bound by social conventions. You know, we were able to do a really kind thing for this other group of young kids who came over there because it really enlivened their experience to engage something else. And mostly it just got them thinking to expect the unexpected, because I think that's really one of the most important things I can impart to a child who comes here, is that the world doesn't have to be just the way everyone expects that it should be. Because once you can get outside of that paradigm, ideas like liberty and a voluntary society are a lot more palatable.
Has this spread to any other schools? Have you influenced anybody, or do you offer information on how other schools can follow your model?
Well, you know, we actually haven't rolled out this idea for the school yet. It's still very much in the infancy stages, although we have a few people we're discussing the details with it up here, and we hope to put it in place by next fall. But the one way I have been able to influence folks and change people's minds is I've been doing a lot of consulting with churches and how they interact with their kids, and taking the coercion out of the church and child relationship. And you know from speaking with me that I really believe that that a faith doesn't have to be something that tries to control someone, that it can actually be something that helps free someone. And this, certainly the Christian faith language is one that a lot of people speak. And when you can communicate to them that their faith might inform them to treat people lovingly and to give people freedom, I found that this can be a really powerful thing. And so I've been able to help some churches in that way. And in addition, I've also worked with a handful of other camps who have noted our success, and said, how did you do that? what was the silver bullet? And it's been really interesting because, you know, the camp when I got here was on very, very tough financial times. And this area in particular is just becoming eviscerated financially. And just this last year, we increased the camper retention from 63%. So this is the kids that come back from one year to the next, up to 86%, which was more than 21% ahead of the national average, and then increased enrollment overall by 70%, 68%. And that was in a year where camps as a whole shrunk. So, and you know, we didn't increase from 6 to 8 or whatever, we increased from 210 to 347. And this was all based on the excitement generated around this child-centered environment. So I think in a very market-based way, people are observing, hey, you're having financial success. We want to repeat it. Show us how. So that's been really kind of neat. Just because I believe in the way we're interacting with kids, but from a kind of a market-based perspective too, you know.
Have you thought about writing a book?
You know, I did. I blog, kind of. I write, you know, my wife has our little pet website there that we don't keep up with as well as we would want to, but I also write about our philosophy in running camp on the camp's website as a communique with parents and other camps. I think we're building towards something like that, although I'm not sure if I'm not sure what the book is about yet, you know. I'm not sure if the book is about parenting, if it's about childcare or education, or if it's about just running camp. I think the thing I do best is run camp. I'm not as good a parent as I am a camp director just yet. I still have a lot of work to do there, but I think we'll see. You know, I think if we have great success in parenting and in this, you know, schooling model, that I really do believe in spreading the word about it. I think that could be a really powerful message.
Excellent. So what else you got today?
What else I got today? That's a great question. I have infinity things.
Go for
it. If you want to give me a platform.
Education. Sure, sure. So, I'm liking education or kids, you know, both, same, different.
Yeah, well, this is something I think that'll resonate with you. So I don't know. You may have actually posted this. It was a little Liberty meme going around recently.
That's kind of funny when this happens. This has happened before. I don't know if this is what you're hinting at, but I've made up a meme or a saying, put it on the internet, and then 6 months later, somebody forwards it to me and says, this seems like something you'd really like. So, and I'm actually creating a meme while we're talking right now. It's about Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia. So I'll just leave it at that and keep working in Photoshop here while you tell what you were going to say.
Oh, cool. So I don't know if you saw this thing where it was an anchor from MSNBC. She was talking about how kids don't belong to their parents, how they belong to the community. So this was a big source of outrage for people that I'm close with, like in the homeschooling and unschooling communities. Basically, this woman came forward and she was saying very seriously how it's been this long pervaded myth that raising the child is the responsibility of a parent, and then how in actuality a child and what that child learns is the responsibility of the community, because the child belongs to the community. And I thought, of course, that this is a very, very troubling and extremely status and central planning idea. And so I did what any good liberty hero would do. I engaged someone in a Facebook debate, and I got in a very interesting conversation with a woman who, you know, very interestingly was saying things like that I'm the problem, you know, that I'm part of the problem with education today. And it's all she equated me to Ayn Rand and who else, like Pat Buchanan, and just all these people who I don't equate myself with at all. And just basically caring, you know, claiming that I want the kids in Detroit to be, you know, eating mush and never getting a college education and so on. And I find it to be really fascinating from two perspectives. You know, number one, I think it's insane that people could point to the current system and say that it's the free market that's causing all the problems in education. I think that's, could it be more backward? This woman linked an article to supposedly the countries that don't have public education and the state that they're in. And so she linked this article. Of course, it was the Congo and Ivory Coast and Sudan and all these places that incidentally all do have public education, but just that's run really poorly. And public education that people are taxed for and then have to pay for also. So just basically models of public education that are infinitely worse than our current model of public education. So my point to her is, great. I know that the U.S. doesn't have literally the worst education in the world, so I'm not so concerned about that. But that this notion further that, you know, we just need to pour more money into this failing business, you know, that if we could just put more money into it, that'll be the thing that gets it over the top. You know, just another $100 per student, $1,000 per student. If we just didn't spend money on war, if we spent that on education, that would solve the problem, and that we all have this fiduciary duty to educate everyone for free. And I just think it's the most insane and backward approach to business, you know, as a businessman myself, and as one yourself, I'm sure you can speak to, like, you know, if people were unsatisfied with guns and weed, the road to freedom, and you said, no problem, you know, next year I'll charge $30 for the DVD, and I promise this will really be great, you know? Like, how insane would that be, right? I mean, you would literally just couldn't hear that story because you would so instantly be out of business that you would never even get to that big ask when you charge five times what your product should cost, you know? But that is the state business model, is pay more, like where competition drives prices down in every other avenue, competition or lack of success drives prices up in the state. And it's a really big puzzle. You know, I really don't know how to get to the bottom of that quagmire in a lot of ways. I don't know. Do you see that sort of stuff in other businesses? Is it just school that demands more money? I don't even know.
It's really, in my observation, and I study this a lot, you know, from a cursory, non-scientific, non-government funded scientist level. It pretty much seems to only exist where the government is involved. And, you know, people, you have the Occupy Wall Street people. They're complaining about, you know, the corporations is the problem. And they really should be occupying Congress, because without the government, there are not corporations. There could be business, there could be big business, but it wouldn't be able to behave in the unethical, unethical, non-ethical, anti-ethical way that corporations do. That is a construct of the government. You know, when you have, I was thinking the other day about TurboTax. My friend was filing his taxes on TurboTax and having a really bad problem with it. And they probably don't even exist in conjunction with the government in the way that, you know, like say, the people that come out and inspect your house before the government will let you sell it, which, you know, in the market, we don't call it the free market at the Fiends. We call it the market, because the word free market is redundant and it's misused. Right. So we just call it the market. But in the market, any smart buyer and seller would inspect their house before they sell it. But the, you know, when we bought our house, the lady didn't even check for radon gas or anything like that. I had to do that. She just came and said, okay, this window on the back in the backyard where nobody can see anything needs to be painted, and you need to pay me to come back and look at it after you've painted it. I'm like, what's that got to do with safety? You know, that's like a window that's facing a fence that no one can see, but that's what they were concerned about. So, you know, I mean, that's something that's in conjunction with the government. TurboTax probably isn't in conjunction with the government, except that Timothy Geithner sort of endorsed it by saying, I'm the guy in charge of all the tax codes, but I can't understand taxes. So I did mine on TurboTax and made mistakes and owed money. But yeah, with things that aren't necessarily tied into, that aren't tied in at all to the government, business models that just rely on the market where you're not forced to buy the product from the company. Like for instance, in LA, we had private trash pickup, but we had to pick from a list of 3 state approved ones. So, you know, they could pretty much act like the government and act like they wanted and spill your trash and not pick it up on time and then pick it up a day late and get away with it because they were a corporation in bed with the government. But yeah, the companies that aren't involved with the government offer really good service or go out of business, you know, and people that are.
Right, so I have trouble with that.
Yeah. Well, I do too. And that's what I spend most of my time talking about. I mean, yeah, that's. And the thing is, when companies do really, really, really well on their own with their own business model of just providing great service like Amazon, and they get really, really, really big because of it, then the government, or Google, then the government comes in and tries to take them over anyway, to the point where, like, now Google, you know, is turning things over without a warrant to the government. And Amazon is like, yeah, we're all in favor, actually in favor, not just, yeah, we'll do it, but they're in favor of the proposed federal income tax on anything sold on the internet. And one reason that companies, when they get really big, do that in conjunction with the government. Like another one is big tobacco is starting to get into e-cigs now, you know, the ones that have vapor and aren't as bad for you and don't cause cancer. Big tobacco is going, okay, this is a threat. We're going to start selling it. And big tobacco is actually lobbying to increase the taxes on it, because the taxes on it right now are just sales tax. There's no nicotine tax like there is on tobacco. And they're trying to, the taxes that they're pushing for aren't as high as tobacco taxes, but they're higher than none, you know, just sales tax right now. There's no tobacco tax or nicotine tax on it. And the reason that they're pushing for a tax on that is because they can afford it and all the smaller companies can't. So corporations do things like that because the government is in bed with them and they're in bed with the government.
Okay, so help me with this then, because this is exactly the conversation I wind up having with folks a lot of times. It's twofold. You know, number one, it's that corporations rule the world thing where they're worried about the dystopian future where, like, Walmart owns all the water and is charging people $1,000 a gallon and stuff. Or, you know, that once we turn the environment over to big business, so-called big business, that they're going to destroy the world. I have trouble sometimes communicating why that won't happen. I mean, from strictly the corporations taking over thing, I get that that's sort of the it's the government corporation system is what causes monopoly privilege and, you know, all this insane and their ability to own property that they can't defend and, you know, and so on and so forth. But the other thing, the environmental thing, the what's good for the market is good for the world in the long run. Specifically the environmental piece. Do you have a perspective on that?
I don't know, man. When people say who would build the roads and that's their Facebook argument, not saying that you're limiting down to that, but I'm not really the guy to ask. I'm not going to be the central planner in libertarian paradise. And I really strongly believe that just because I don't personally have the answer doesn't mean it couldn't be done way better than it's being done now. There are people who, sure, you know, do podcasts every day talking about how that could work, and I'm not one of them. So I'm
not me neither, you know, and that's why I asked.
I don't know.
Because
don't know, man.
I don't go down that road either.
Just because I don't have the answer, I mean, a lot of Facebook arguers would say, "See, that proves you're wrong and I'm right." But you know, a lot of Facebook arguers can't tell you how a rocket works, but they think there should be rockets.
Oh, totally. And I'm not exactly. And this is what I wind up saying pretty much. But I find it to be, and I know from my perspective, if I was, you know, in a debate competition, that the person wouldn't beat me based on that point. But I'm not so worried about beating them in the argument. I just really want them to understand. You know, I really want to have the answer in that moment. So they can see, oh, okay. And so, you know, I'll turn them to The Market for Liberty or other books like that that deal with these topics on a one-by-one basis. But I just wind up leaving conversations so dissatisfied because I just want people to see that it just starts with loving one another, you know, and that loving one another also means only engaging in voluntary interaction. And I really, really, really do believe that LibPair is possible, you know, this notion of sort of heaven on earth, right, where people are only engaging in voluntary interactions, and those who don't are so quickly dealt with and ostracized, and not just ostracism, but just sort of that we have this critical mass of people only engaging in voluntary interactions. So this is sort of the only thing you learn. Like, I really, like a lot of people are like, well, it won't be perfect in LibPair someday. I'm not sure that's true. Like, I think it really might be, because I've seen this at camp, you know. One of the things we do is we get rid of all rules designed for adult convenience. And so there's no rules about inside voices. You know, the notion of bedtime is only limited to you as a person and the amount to which you're keeping anyone else up. My counselors aren't entitled to yell at anyone. They're not entitled to give anyone a countdown to rush them, you know. But we are really, really firm about people interacting with each other peacefully, you know, obviously physically and then emotionally too. And what we find is that when we emphasize these rules and it doesn't take long. Like, once there's a critical mass of people on board, then the person who's coming in and trying to gossip just immediately understands that this is making them an outsider, and so they stop. And so I almost never, ever, ever, I think only one time in the 2 summers I've been here, if I had to intervene in a social situation where there was, like, bullying going on. And it's because when everyone sees that this is for the benefit of the community, they just do it, you know. And these aren't all privileged white kids. You know, we get some really rough and tumble kids from the city. We get rural poor, you know, and I really believe that this is the way the world will work once we just take out the indoctrination that coercion is necessary and that there's this pecking order of, well, someone's got to be in charge, so it might as well be me. I think once we get rid of that life might just be great. Like, people might just interact with each other peacefully pretty much only, but maybe I am Pollyannish or something. I don't know.
I don't know about that. So what do you see for the future of you and of the country you live in?
Well, for the future of me, I think it could go in a couple different ways. You know, my wife and I are really drawn to the Free State Project. We haven't signed up for it because we are not comfortable saying that we'll definitely do it just yet. We have a really great situation here for our family. Where, like I said, we are essentially living free in a lot of ways. I mean, I in a business sense, I deal with these regulations, but, you know, no property tax, no tax on purchases. You know, our income is low enough through the being paid through the camp, and given our housing and food and all that stuff is paid for. So we don't really pay much taxes in that realm. And we have this big, beautiful place to live. And so it's hard to imagine leaving, but I also just despise New York State and the regulations with, like, every fiber of my being. So it's really hard to live in such an unfree place. Like the town, a few towns over, like banned roommates a few months ago. It's a really crazy place to be from that perspective.
Your town banned having roommates?
Not my town, but two towns over, there's a place called Watertown. And this is, it's a city north of Syracuse. And a council person proposed to ban roommates, people living living with each other who weren't married. This is my understanding from reading the article.
Now, is that a religious thing or there's too many people in our town thing? What was their point of that? What was their motivation?
I don't recall what her justification was. I'm not sure she provided justification. I think she just proposed it to the council and they did it. It's a 5-person council who made a town ordinance. I think it was because it was too noisy. And I think that was it. I think it was just too noisy. You get all these people living together and they make life worse for everyone else. And so, New York State is pretty much the worst. It's really, really bad, but, on the same, it's this weird juxtaposition. So like we live free and we encounter a lot of people like in homeschooling and unschooling communities who care about this stuff. So from that perspective, it's great, but I feel like I could affect so much more change and encounter so many more like-minded individuals, if we moved somewhere. And I feel like the work we could do in a place like New Hampshire, you know, especially with creating this sort of, subversive unschooling co-op would really do so much more in an area where, you know, freedom is somewhat possible in a 50-year time frame, you know. So we're kind of torn, you know. I think if our life is good enough here, we'll probably just stay because we care more about our lives than other people's lives. It's just like most people. But
yeah.
I could definitely see a scenario. I think if we wind up moving, that's probably where we'll go.
Well, cool. You got any closing comments or statements there, James?
No, man. Just happy to chat. And I wind up doing a lot of talking. I appreciate the platform because I just like to, you know, talk about stuff that's going on with me and my ideas. And, you know, I really, if anyone wants to write me an email or something or send me a message, you can find me on Facebook. I'm James Davis. That's my real name. And that's my real Facebook page. If you want to chat about life or liberty or freeing kids and that sort of thing. The blog me and my wife have is libertychildren.com, but we haven't posted there in a little while. If you want to read about the camp, it's vk.org, and that's pretty much it. Anyone who wants to talk liberty and specifically in working with kids, I'd love to. This is my whole life, so I just appreciate the chance to chat.
Excellent, man. Thanks for coming on. Worms. Say worms.
Cool. Worms.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com.
Anarchy Gumbo is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.